It doesn't matter if you discard a compostable cup or a non-compostable cup, whether it's paper or poly, it's just going to sit there for hundreds, if not thousands of years and do almost nothing. I seen one cell where we out in Wyoming, they were digging and they pulled out a newspaper, I believe from the 50s, just to print a newspaper, and you can read it clear as day, everything that was on it.
Huh.
It's just you remove all the oxygen from that material. It just doesn't have a chance to decompose.
Welcome to Unboxed, a new packaging design series where each week we'll discuss everything from concept development and design to material selection and recycling. Everything you need to know about package design. In this episode of Package Design Unboxed, we speak to Bo Peck, Director of Marketing and Zero Waste Services with Pro Recycling Group. Today, you get to see the other side of packaging and find out that your pack's life doesn't end with the unboxing. It goes on to feed the supply chain of another business, recycling.
All right, thanks for joining me today. We've got Bo Peck, the Director of Marketing and Zero Waste Services with the Pro Recycling Group out of Utah. How you doing, Bo?
Doing well yourself?
I'm doing awesome, man. Just getting through coronavirus lockdown like everybody else, right?
We're enjoying every minute of it. Good to be home,
Absolutely.
though. Good to be home.
Absolutely. So you're in Utah. Bo, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how the Pro Recycling Group works and kind of a little bit about what you do.
So, my name is Bo Peck, just as I mentioned. Our company, the Pro Recycling Group, is made up of two main companies: Interwest Paper, which is a material brokerage company and recycler based out of Salt Lake City. We handle materials out of seven western states, everything surrounding Utah and the Salt Lake City area. And we have an equipment division called Pro Baler Services that offers recycling and waste equipment for the industry. My role, I'm Director of Marketing and Zero Waste Services. So I help market a lot of our paper and plastic materials to final market, and also our in-plant service recycling team. I manage that program as well. So we have a team that actually does recycling for large companies, and then we have a team inside their plants doing the recycling at the source. So I do a lot of rural recycling. So kind of my favorite thing to do in my work day is to work with small recycling centers. So for instance, this is stuff that's out of a major city. So a small community, you might have a population of 200 or 10,000 people. I like to help set up those recycling programs, get their materials to market, and really network from the ground up. So you're working with a lot of government agencies, landfills, private citizens. It's really fun to get involved. It's really detailed, and you get to learn all the little quirks from little small towns in Wyoming, Idaho, central southern Utah, Nevada. It's really fun traveling the western states and seeing how small towns network and recycle. So I kind of get out there from our big corporate companies that we deal with to the small scale people
That's
working hard.
awesome.
It's fun industry to be in.
So going out and setting up recycling programs for some of these smaller cities, what does that entail? Is that everything from the curbside system, or is it mostly industrial?
So we like to promote what we call clean stream recycling. So we don't typically do the normal curbside recycling that a big corporation or a big city would be involved with. What we promote is source separation at the location itself. So for instance, if you're in a big city, you're probably used to putting everything into one bin, and then it goes to a recovery facility where they sort everything out. A lot of small towns and all of our corporate businesses, we tell them to sort everything on site. So if you go visit one of these rural recycling centers, you're going to have to place all your number one plastics in one bin, all your paper and packaging materials in another bin, and you kind of go on your routes, kind of like going to the post office or the
Right.
grocery store. You make it a part of your routine. And you are educated on how to properly sort, and you do it on site, and the result is a lot cleaner product for the industry. And so we don't do anything mixed or commingled, is the term used in our industry.
Sure. And that's what would be my curbside bin would be just commingled.
Correct.
Cause it's everything from pizza boxes to Amazon packs, right? Like just whatever I think is recyclable, I'll throw in there. It's kind of the reality, right?
That's the reality. And we get a lot of what we call wishful recycling, where we hope it can be recycled. And so we try to force it in. The hard thing that I don't like about a curbside program is it's a closed lid system. So once you place it in that bin and you close the lid, you tend to forget about it. Where if you have to manually take your recycling in your personal car and drive it down somewhere, you typically have to look at it several times and you have to smell it. So you're more concerned about having contaminants on a soup can or a beverage can. You want it to be a little bit cleaner and drier than you normally would do if you had that convenience item as such as a recycle bin at home.
Why don't we all have this clean stream recycling? Why do we have these commingled systems in place?
Sheer convenience. So the industry in the 90s and upwards really pushed convenience, and the overall goal of the industry was to get as much tonnage reclaimed as possible. And so convenience was the number one issue. So a lot of these programs switched how they recycled and went a different route just to get more tonnage. But what we're seeing now, especially after countries such as China have pulled out of the market, is quality is almost more important than quantity. And so I think the national average for residual waste on a curbside program is about 18%. A lot of communities I deal with that are a larger city, their numbers are 20% or more contamination or residual waste in that stream. So just the way we recycle, a good portion of it, a fifth of it, is not recyclable, and we end up throwing it out and kind of harming the system at the same time. So in a clean stream situation, there's a lot more controls in place, and you have to put it in the bin itself, and nearly 99% of a program will be recycled, just because you're there in front of a citizen, and you can say, no, that Amazon bag that has plastic and paper mixed in the one is not recyclable. Don't bring it to us. And it's just a lot more on a personal level of what can be recycled and what not.
Sure. So you're educating the populace in real time, right? When I bring it to you and, you know, I bring that Amazon bag to you that's not recyclable, you'll tell me next time I know not to put it in, basically.
Exactly. Yeah, because it's really confusing in the industry. We want to do the right thing. We want to recycle as much as we can. But the reality is there's so many packaging items in the world that's where the consumer gets really confused really fast, because we want to try. We want to try the best that we can. But sometimes those efforts end up making life hard for the people that actually have to recycle it.
So as we get through all those different combinations of materials, the molded fibers, the EPE foams, the laminates, and we start combining those things, I see that that's where we run into a lot of problems in the recycling system. How does somebody typically in a closed lid system, you know, sort that stuff out?
Well, honestly, if it's in a closed lid system, they end up throwing it in without really thinking about who has to deal with that product. That industry is really fast paced. And ultimately, if it's something that the recycler does not want, it's kind of an imaginary tale that, oh, someone else is going to take the time to pick through this package and remove plastic clips or plastic windows from that product and do all that work for me. But it's so fast paced that it ends up just being discarded as quickly as it comes in the plant, because it's on to the next thing down the line, because these are very, very fast speed systems that people don't have time for. The industry doesn't have time to slow it down and to nitpick through some of those items.
Sure. And what do you think of, so as we kind of move forward, a lot of brands are looking to use mono-material packaging systems, which is great in that the concept is great in that all the materials made out of paperboard, you know, the same material, or it's all made out of the same PET, so that it can easily then be recycled as one unit. Are you seeing an increase in that, or has that not really impacted you?
I am starting to see it in some brands. So one company that I've been following is a company out of California called Green Toys, and they manufacture a plastic toy that's made entirely out of recycled HDPE. But what really caught my eye was the packaging of the box. So they avoid using any type of plastic inserts, such as a plastic window, plastic bolts or carriages. So sometimes when you buy a toy, it's fastened to the box with several pieces of plastic, whether it's a zip tie or a clip tie or something more rigid. And they developed a box that was solely just a corrugated container, just a normal brown cardboard box, and that's it. And it had the toy inside, and the way that the box closed around the toy, it provided a secure enough vessel that it wasn't damaged on the store shelf. It was pretty rigid, so you don't see a lot of discarded products just because the box started degrading. But it was easily recyclable. So my dream in the market is to see more corrugated boxes used in products like that, just because they are easily recyclable pretty much everywhere. Because when you get down into the nitty gritty, there's a lot of exceptions to the industry where if you start having a lot of different types of paperboard or have a lot of PET packaging, the recyclability of those items really gets harder and harder the further away you get from market. But at least that box really caught my eye, because it's like, oh, this is a really good concept where, hey, this is fully recyclable. Everything about it is really good for the end user of the industry. And I would love to see more of it.
So let's say compostable plastics, for example. What's your take on compostable plastics?
My honest opinion on, as of right now, that type of plastic is new and exciting, and I see the need for it. But the reality is the facilities to actually compost it don't exist in many, many areas. And I do a lot of work in landfills, and I think the funnest thing to do is if you can find an old cell at a landfill and try to be there where they're digging a test pit for something. The reality of when something enters a landfill, unless they're really adding a lot of air back into that system and trying to push out the methane for a methane collection system, the reality is not a lot happens once that cell is capped off. And it doesn't matter if you discard a compostable cup or a non-compostable cup, whether it's paper or poly, it's just going to sit there for hundreds, if not thousands of years and do almost nothing. I've seen one cell where we out in Wyoming, they were digging and they pulled out a newspaper, I believe from the 50s. Just to print a newspaper, and you can read it clear as day, everything that was on it. It's just you remove all the oxygen from that material. It just doesn't have a chance to decompose. So for me, I don't really see a need to pay extra for a good that if you don't have the facilities in place, you're ultimately just adding more cost to a consumer to feel good about it, but then it just gets thrown away. What I want to see more in the environment, and it's up and coming, is the facilities that can properly process that material. But then again, that's a whole nother set of issues that one can have, because it gets from what I've seen in the industry, gets really complex. So a lot of it takes certain temperatures to decompose. Some of that packaging, if you read the definitions on it, it says it might take up to 3 years to decompose in an industrial facility. So each product has its own different limitations and problems. And some of the products sound really good, and some are good because they're more paper based, and they do almost decompose within weeks. But there is a lot on the market that are more plastic based that are totally different. And depending on the site that's handling it, some can handle the material and some cannot handle the material. And the reality is there's so few facilities that exist and it's different across the board for each and every one of them. So it's a very, very complex issue to try to recycle those items.
No, absolutely. And, you know, I think with compostables, I always go back to there's some packaging out there that claims to be home compostable, or some materials that claim to be home compostable. And you can put it in your compost bin and it'll break down, and then, you know, you're to reutilize that as fertilizer, but ultimately what are you putting back into the soil that you're going to feed your family with? You know, that's a question that you have to ask yourself. And I think it's kind of the same thing. If it's an industrial compost facility, is who are they selling that compost to? And do those consumers, are they looking for those chemicals and byproducts be in that material? Which kind of leads me to recycling isn't being done out of the goodness of people's hearts. You know, recycling is being done because it's a business. So how do we get into, you know, can you tell me a little bit about the business of recycling? You're reselling this product to someone else. Is that correct?
That is correct. So the best way to tell people how recycling works is you got to change how they view it. So a lot of people view it that, you bundle something up and you make money at it and everyone can do it. Yes and no. But the reality is recyclers are manufacturers of raw products. So for instance, if you have a farmer, maybe one farmer is a grain farmer and he's farming wheat, and the farmer next to him is a farmer and he's gathering up corn. They each take their bushels of corn and wheat to market, and they have certain expectations that they have to meet. So if they're going to grind that down and take that wheat and make flour, they can't have any other items in there. They can't have any corn mixed in with that bushel. It has to be clean. It has to be free from dirt, mold, all kinds of stuff to be able to market that material. Same with the corn. You can't have a couple of grains of wheat in with that bushel of corn, because people have items such as food allergies and you're concerned about the quality of product. Recycling is much that way. So when a recycler bundles, for instance, a bale of cardboard, that is a raw ingredient that is going to be marketed and transported to a new facility to make new paper goods. And it is critical that item that mill is purchasing is clean, pristine, and ready to go. And if there's any issues with it, it really puts a halt on the recycling process in the industry. And so when people start to think of recycling more as a good, as a resource, that's the reality in recycling. So if I have, for instance, a lot of plastic windows in my cardboard bale because the packaging that was generated in there has all those items in there, it ultimately is a contaminant that is going to mess up the paper making process. They have safeguards in place that clean that paper, but ultimately if it gets too excessive, they're buying material and ultimately throwing a part of it away, so it becomes less valuable to that end user if there's a lot of contamination.
Sure. And that seems to be part of the reason that we went through the national sword policy with China, right? Where we were sending a lot of materials like those, and then ultimately they were paying for the labor to then resort it.
That's exactly what happened. So a lot of the materials that got caught up into the national sword and the green fence era recycling issues, I would say close to 100% of those materials were materials that our domestic mill system said no to. And they said no to it decades ago. When the commingled recycling from cities and large counties really started taking off, for a while the mill systems domestically were able to consume it, but as contamination grew higher, ultimately they said no, and it was just kind of a weird coincidence that there was another group in the mix that was willing to purchase that material, and they did for a long time, and it's always kind of been questionable why were they buying it at a price so comparable to what our domestic mill systems were buying for, and it's just a subpar product. Our companies stayed away from those streams just because we knew they were too dirty. They were impossible to market to our domestic mill systems. The only choice that was out there was our export situations, but even then it was hard to export. Quality was always an issue, and if you get a container out to sea and you end up shipping it overseas, that one container might be worth $1,000, maybe $2,000 depending on the grade, and if you get rejected, it's about a $5,000 fine because you have to eat the freight to get it there and then pay for that container to come back to your country of origin. Wow. And it's just not worth the risk. So it's kind of odd that the recycling industry tolerated dirty items for so long, but that's the beautiful thing about the whole China fence. People kind of feel, oh, the Chinese were buying it and now they don't want to buy it, so it's their fault. But the reality is it's our fault as a recycling community for letting our tolerations of cleanliness in products to get out of control. And it's not everyone. It's a select few that really hampered it for everyone. But the reality is it was too dirty for even us to deal with. And it was a massive reset button that got pushed on the industry. And ultimately, that's a good thing because it forces us to do a better job. It forces us to stop and say, hey, well, what has changed over the last decade that it's now really become a problem that a whole country says no to the world? And the reality is the products that we create have been way too complicated, and the stream has not been monitored closely enough for quality assurance that they just had to say, no, we're done. And so it's a good opportunity for box producers and the recycling community to network more. And then now we can step back and say, we don't have an option B anymore. Option B is totally off the table. We now have to focus on option A, and we just have to change the way that we package our products in this country. And it's going to ultimately help everything out and make it easier to recycle and more profitable, hopefully, for all parties involved.
We see the raw goods as part of the supply chain on the way in. That's, you know, building the product and building the packaging, and then once it delivers as a whole unit and then goes to the customer, the idea is that the supply chain ends. But the truth is that supply chain just shifts in that supply chain now is becoming your supply chain.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. You know, we're feeding that beast with plastics and paper and foams and all those other things. So if there's, you know, if you could talk to every packaging designer out there and give them, you know, these are the three things that you've got to consider when putting together packaging that will, you know, support recycling and support your business, you know, what would those, what do you think those things would be?
The biggest recommendation would be to go brown. So having one type of paper that is mostly used in the industry would help out greatly. So cardboard is one of the easiest items to recycle more on a widespread territory. So what gets really complicated with mixed paper markets is it changes per demographic, where certain mail systems might not want a specific mix. It might not work as good, but the consistent thing in the industry is brown corrugated packaging is pretty much universal. That if we can create more products that is a brown woven corrugated box, and limit such items such as UV coatings or how we print, that makes it the easiest way to recycle everything. Second would be to limit the use of dual products such as paper and poly items in one. We like the windows on there because they really protect our product. And consumer safety's a number one factor, but trying to find different ways to remove those poly windows out of a lot of packaging really, really helps the recycler, because we don't have time to sit and pull those windows out. They're typically glued in there really heavily, and the plastic that's in them, even though they might be PET, ultimately won't get recycled. PET is a great polymer to use for packaging, but it gets really tricky on actually recycling it. So in my yard right now, I have about 40,000 pounds of a PET tray, and these are separated out on the industrial side, and they're just a bolt tray used in a manufacturing process. And with oil pricing going down with the COVID virus, it's ultimately worth almost nothing. I can't give it away at this point, and it's premium clean product, but I can't recycle it. It's one of those things that it goes up and down, but even on good markets, it's sure. You have to plead with people to please take it, just because there's not enough end users that can consume it.
Understanding oil prices are negative at this point. When you say that you can't recycle it, you can recycle it, but you don't have a buyer on the back
end. That's correct.
Right,
so when you recycle, if you shift gears to plastics, all plastics are recyclable. And then there's a whole bunch of buts. And those buts are, if I want to recycle a certain type of resin, the general rule is I have to have 40,000 pounds, which is a standard truckload of freight. I have to have that minimum to be able to recycle it. So if I have 40,000 pounds of it, the chances of me recycling it are about 95%. That's the biggest hurdle. So there's a lot of plastics out there that it's really difficult to collect that much material from consumers and then get it clean enough that I can make bales of that product.
Sure. And you're not going to collect small amounts and build them up to 40,000 pounds over,
and then,
over time.
The second issue with plastics is there's so many different grades. So most consumers are pretty familiar with the little recycling Mobius on the bottom of a pop container or a shampoo bottle. And that numbering system goes through 1 through 7. That's the standard chart of what type of resin that is. Unfortunately, what consumers don't know is there's a whole list of, items that are added to that. So that number 7 symbol that many people see is reserved for other. And in our company alone, so we operate a large regrind facility in our Salt Lake City plant. We probably on a normal week deal with about 40 different types of resins every week. So on top of the the normal 1 through 7 that we see, that's a small, small carrot of what is actually out there. And it differs. So what grades a type of plastic is the type of polymer it is, the color, the melting point, and also the hardiness of it, or if there's any additives. So plastics are very, very versatile, where they give us so many attributes that we can't get with a normal fiber container. We can add strength to these items. So we can fill plastic with glass. We can fill plastic with calcium. We can do things to make it harder or more impact resistant. We can do things with plastic, such as make it more flexible. Maybe we want to build a flexible packaging or something that can move, or something that's more rubber-like. We have so many different options, but on the recycle end, that ultimately makes it that much harder to recycle, because now you have so many different factors. And what I have to find is a home for that material for someone that can use that exact specific grade. So I might be sitting on a load of PET trays, but it's not the same as a PET drinking bottle that we're used to. It still says PET #1 on the label, but they have totally different characteristics and melting points, and they can't be recycled in the same facility that recycles a pop bottle, for instance. So that's where it gets really, really complicated on the recycle side. They're not the same products. If that makes sense.
Sure. So if anybody was going to be working with plastics, you know, would you recommend that they stick to, you know, even though there's so many different grades, you know, sticking to say 1 through 3, through plastics 1 through 3 versus getting into some of those more mixed materials? Does that increase the opportunity for that to be recycled?
Sometimes it depends on what it is. For a consumer at home, in most, if you're looking at a whole demographic as far as geography of what can be recycled over a widespread area, the most two common things that are recycled are a #1 bottle, so with a screw lid, and a #2 bottle with a screw lid. Mm-hmm. Other resins have different melting points and different attributes that may not allow it to be recycled in certain programs. And so other than the bottles that we generate at home, pretty much everything else cannot be recycled in a typical manner. There's so many different items that make it really complex. For instance, the use of similar resins. So like if I'm making a window on a box, that window could be made out of polystyrene. It could be made out of PET. It can be made out of polypropylene. And from the consumer point of view, it all looks like a plastic window on a cardboard box. But to a recycler,
right,
we have 3 different resins, and that doesn't include using a PVC. So there's 4 common resins that can be used that give similar characteristics, but almost make it impossible to recycle, just because they look so similar that we can't see what they are on our front. We have a really hard time identifying the type of resin it is, just because they all look so similar.
And that's the challenge for packaging designers, is really to educate yourself on the materials Yes. that you're selecting, making sure that what you've actually selected, there's a need for it after recycling, that there's a demand for it. And then ultimately that your supplier, whoever you're working with to produce those, are in fact using the materials that you've selected.
Right.
Because from our perspective, it's nearly impossible to tell the difference between the two materials without, you know, involving a third party actually. Mm-hmm.
And what makes it really difficult is geographic area. So if you try to recycle something, say in LA, you might have a better chance of having fulfillment for a lot of those exceptions versus someone that might be out in central Colorado or central Wyoming that has a totally different program. So building those products that can withstand a really wide tolerance of recyclers is a good thing to keep in mind, because we see a lot of products out there that are, that might be recyclable in one or two areas, but then they're marketed as a whole that this is recyclable. You can recycle it anywhere. And the reality is, well, no. One product that I came about that I get questions on all the time is there's a PET mat. It's a non-woven mat that's used as a packaging filler, and it's made entirely out of PET. And the label that's printed on it says, I can be recycled with PET bottles anywhere. And so it's this white mat. Oh, right. It kind of looks like a pillow. And sure. It's got these nice logos on it that says, I'm recyclable everywhere. Well, you take that to the places that I sell my PET bottles. Hey, what do you guys think of this? Oh, it's not recyclable. It's not the same thing. we really have to do right. better as an industry and really go from A to Z, where there's probably a case that there is a PET bottle recycler that can take it, you know, because we all have different processes on how we take that product, but we've skipped the step to make sure that it can be recycled everywhere. And kind of lost the boat. And so what really gets hurt is the recyclers at the end of it, because we now have to educate, and it says, well, it says right on here, I can recycle it. And it just doesn't work right. every single place.
When I've spoken to different MRFs and such, as anything that's non-woven is typically not recycled, because the threads in there essentially just gum up the works. You know, if they're doing a bulk load of non-woven polypropylene, for example, that stuff can just, you know, bind itself in some of the machine.
Oh, absolutely. So what a lot of curbside recycling processing facilities can't really handle is a lot of flexible items. So a non-woven or a plastic bag, it's just not made for the processing equipment, and it just gets wrapped around conveyors and sorting screens, and it just makes a mess for the industry. It's just, and then on top of that, we got to go back to the original scenario. I got to have 40,000 pounds of that one item to be able to even market it. So if I put that non-woven in there, that means I got to go find so much more material to complete that bell. If I can even make a bell of it, then I got to find 40 other bells to marry up with it to make a load of that material. It's kind of mind-boggling when you see the sheer volume that's needed. So keeping it simple is really the best strategy on that.
Your points, right? Your recommendations. You've got going brown, you know, staying with cardboards. You know, the paper-based stuff is really what we want to focus on. You know, the mixed papers. Regionally, some areas might not want that. You mentioned UV coatings, you know, not having UV coatings on certain things. How big of an issue is that when you see packaging with UV coatings on it? Is that immediately a non-recyclable?
It just makes it harder to recycle. So a lot of UV coatings are pretty much like a poly coating adhere to the outermost layer of that product. And it's kind of a give and take. So if you're selling a product that might sit outside for a few months, so you want to protect that product so that product does not end up becoming waste first and foremost. So there is an importance right. to it. The industry can tolerate a lot of those coatings, but it does make it a lot more difficult. If they were gone completely, I buy a lot of poly board just from the printing industry. So when you make a lot of those boxes, there's cutouts and stuff that are ultimately baled on site, and they're premium grade materials. When you have those UV coatings, the market share that I can send that material to cuts down by about 80%. So you can't just take it to a standard mill. They got to be set up where they can take that UV coating and mix it in with other materials. And even then they just don't love it. It's just, it's another contaminant that makes it rough in the system. And then recyclers have to be really careful not to accidentally send product that might have UV to a mill that cannot take a UV coating, because you can shut them down. And if you shut them down, you lose your contract, you lose your relationship, and they want to buy. Yeah, it gets expensive. And you, the last thing you ever want to do in the recycling industry is be responsible for shutting down a mill. You will lose a lot of friends really quickly. And
so are we talking about like one bag with UV coating on it can shut down?
Some mills are that sketchy. Yeah, depending on what you throw in there, you can really upset the system. It's just like if I'm selling a bushel of wheat. If I have a whole truckload of wheat and one bag is contaminated with corn and they just start making flour all day long, and then that bag that has half corn, half wheat enters that system, by the time it gets blended in, the whole thing's gone. That whole vat is gone. They have to ditch it all. And so it's kind of universal how the world works, where recycling is so similar to other industries. That we have to be really, really careful. The fortunate thing is a lot of times in recycling, we can blend a lot of stuff and we can get away with tolerances and stuff. So it's not as critical, but some places it only takes once, and it just takes a little bit to cause issues. So in a wishful world, if poly coatings and UV coatings were limited, it would help the recycling industry on a whole, because it really keeps the value of that paper valuable throughout the whole system and ensures that it can be recycled. Because often when markets go down, the harder to recycle items get hit the hardest.
So you've got that 40,000 pounds sitting out in the yard. How long will you hold on to that before?
As long as we can. That's the difficult thing is everything has a time limit. So paper and plastics, ultimately, they don't last forever. We're susceptible for UV contamination, and weather can have an impact on a lot of paper and products at our plant. And you only have so much time. We do divert to waste energy facilities when the time allows. But ultimately, we want to try to recycle that product first and foremost before doing a plan B option.
This has been extremely educational, super helpful. I know there's a lot of brands out there that have sustainability teams, and they're always looking for new resources. Are you someone that someone within a brand can reach out to either develop a system, learn more about your processes, and just gain more knowledge from you? Is that
absolutely? That you're open to? I feel I can be a good resource because I'm capturing the material on both sides. So the industrial side, when they manufacture that box, are good, and then also on the public side, once it gets out to the public, and I see it in all different demographics, where it's a low population to a high population, and it changes from A to Z when you cross this country. And I'd love to be a resource to anyone that needs it.
So it should be pretty easy to get a hold of you. What's the best
place? LinkedIn is a good resource, or via email.
Okay, perfect. And I'll include your LinkedIn link in the show notes. Just want to remind everybody that recycling is a business and you're part of that supply chain. So just making smart decisions will make
both. And recycling isn't free too. A lot of misconceptions of the industry is it's very, very profitable, but we have a lot of cost involved. So if you typically throw something away, I think the industry stat is it fulfills one job in the industry. And if you recycle it, it's going to support four jobs. So there's a lot more that goes into our way of shipping goods and collecting goods and sorting and baling and marketing. It's very complex. So keep it simple and keep it safe.
Thanks so much, Bo.
Thank you so much.
We'll talk soon, I'm sure.
This has been Package Design Unboxed. Subscribe, rate, and review. Thanks once again to Bo Peck for appearing on the show today. And thanks to you for listening. We'll talk soon.